Yeah, I mean, speaking of the title, so, you know, there's this rule of thumb that the any title that ends in a question mark, the answer is no. So anyway. I hope that's not the case. Okay, so, yeah, well, so, you know, somehow the idea of the talk is, you know, we all want to know what's next. You know, there's this great, you know, the ongoing discovery of the laws of nature is like maybe the greatest story in human history, and we all want to know what the next bit of the puzzle is. You know, what's the next clue that leads to some real bit of decisive progress, the next little step. And you know, one possibility is that, you know, it will come from a new particle being discovered at the LHC, maybe, or by some other experiment. Or another possibility is maybe there'll be some sort of top-down breakthrough, some maybe in string theory, some insight into why the standard model emerges as the correct theory at low energies. But so I want to say that maybe there's a third thing going on. I mean, so I actually increasingly believe there is a third thing going on, and I guess I want to try to convince as many of you as possible of that. But so, you know, I think that there is actually a clue, maybe not a decisive clue, but a rather strong clue hiding in plain sight in the structure of the standard model itself. And stated simply, I think the interpretation of the clue seems to be saying that space-time, instead of being an ordinary four-dimensional continuous manifold, is almost that, but it's a continuous manifold with a discrete finite space that in some sense is six-dimensional, living at each point. Okay, and so this is really, in one way or another, kind of an old idea. It goes back to really the late 80s and early 90s, where it was pioneered by some of these folks, Kahn and Lott and Dubois-Violette and Kerner and Madour. And then it's been developed over the years by a lot of people, including, importantly, by Mari in the audience here. The thing I will describe to you is here is in particular indebted to a number of key ideas from this list of people. I'll try to mention more specifically who did what as I go along. But anyway, but I want to say what I want to explain is that there was a development in our recent paper in April, which I think greatly clarifies the story and really makes it possible to say there is really evidence in favor of this picture over the more traditional effective field theory view of the standard model. And so as I say, not yet decisive evidence, but I want to explain to you the sense in which I think there is evidence. There's one other thing I wanted to clarify before I move on, which is that for the past 25 years, a small group of people have investigated this idea, and certainly the most prominent proponent of this line of reasoning has been the French mathematician Alain Kahn, who has had a number of the key ideas in collaboration with other people, and. But over the years, he's also developed a whole package of related ideas, a whole sort of story involving a lot of different ideas. And just it's important to clarify at the outset that in case you've heard talks by him or will hear talks by him about this, that package of ideas is really separated into a bunch of different bits, even though it's kind of often presented as a single picture. And to my mind, there is really one key idea in there, which is right. And a lot of the other stuff I personally don't agree with. So anyway, I want to tell you the story as I see it. again, it's based on this paper, but I've recently found a new path through it to introduce it, which I think is simpler and hopefully will be, hopefully will be digestible in an hour talk. So just in pictures, we're all familiar with this picture where space-time might be a four-dimensional smooth manifold with some compact dimensions, maybe six-dimensional compact dimensions living at each point. And I want to argue that the standard model seems to be described by a somewhat related picture, which is more like this, with discrete extra dimensions living at each point and finite, which I've sort of schematically represented by these matrices. Okay, so let's dive in. So I want to say that if you look at the traditional way of presenting the standard model, the traditional approach is to regard it as an effective field theory. And now I don't dispute that it is perfectly described by an effective field theory as far as we can see. I'm not arguing that that's merely an approximate description or something like that, and that I have a more accurate description or anything like that. I want to say that I have that there is a deeper way to look at what the standard model is, a way to look at it where in defining the theory you have to give less, and so it explains more. More of the theory becomes output. More of the structure of the theory becomes output rather than input. Okay, so to explain that, let me begin by reviewing for you the traditional view of the standard model as an effective field theory. So in that view, I need to tell you what effective field theory it is. There are millions of, there are an infinite number of effective field theories. Which one is the one that describes our universe? And so to give you that information, I go in three steps. First, I have to tell you the symmetries of the theory. So it's Lorentz invariant. And then in particular, or once we include gravity, it's diff invariant. And then and furthermore, there's this internal symmetry group, the gauge group SU3 times SU2 times U1. So once I specify that, I've also implicitly told you what the gauge bosons are, how many of them there are, how they transform under the gauge group. Okay, and then step two, I have to tell you what the fermions are. So I tell you there's one left-handed, this is one generation of fermions. There's one left-handed quark doublet, the up left and the down left. And there's the corresponding right-handed up quark, the right-handed down quark. And then similarly in the lepton sector, there's a left-handed lepton doublet, the corresponding right-handed neutrino, the corresponding right-handed electron. I should mention, by the way, that I'm including a right-handed neutrino here. Sometimes when you talk about the standard model, traditionally, back in the day, when you talked about the standard model, you didn't include a right-handed neutrino. Since the discovery of neutrino oscillations, people differ about their usage. But the standard way to accommodate neutrino oscillations within a renormalizable model is to include a right-handed neutrino in each generation. But in any case, I'm including it here because on the other perspective, it's going to be forced upon me. So I'm including it for comparison's sake. Okay, and then I have to tell you how these guys transform under the various gauge groups. So the three quarks transform as triplets under SU3. The three leptons transform as singlets under SU3. The left-handed guys transform as doublets under SU2, while the right-handed guys transform as singlets. And then there are some hypercharges, which are almost but not completely determined by anomaly cancellation. Okay. But then there's still step three, which is still completely independent of steps one and two here, which is what are the scalar fields? I've basically told you the spin one particles, the spin one half particles. Now I have to tell you the spin zero particles separately. I could include as many of these as I want, and it's currently an unexplained input that there's just one more line in this table. The Higgs field, and that it transforms in this particular way. It's unexplained why it transforms as a singlet under SU3, doublet under SU2, and with a certain hypercharge. That's just what we need in order to explain observations, but there's no fundamental understanding of where that comes from. Okay, so to introduce the alternative perspective, I just want to start with a initial motivating thought. So normally, think about a single fermion field. So normally, you think of that as a spinner-valued object, where it's spinner-valued over each point x in spacetime. And then, when you go to build the standard model, now you have to use a lot of those spinner fields. So we just saw you use, if you count them up, if you count all the different colors and helicities, you use 16 per generation, or 48 if you include all three generations, or 96 if you also count particles and antiparticles separately. And the suggestion here is to think of this, so the standard perspective is that you're just using a lot of different fermion fields, each of which is valued over the space-time point, space-time coordinate x. But I want to take a different perspective where there's just one fermion field, psi, and it's valued over every point in space-time, but now the space-time is parameterized by two coordinates, a continuous four-dimensional coordinate x and a finite discrete coordinate a, okay, which runs over 48 or 96 values. Okay, and everything will be most beautiful if we group the 16 fermions in a given generation and their corresponding antifermions into an 8x8 block off diagonal matrix like this. And so it's actually no coincidence that they, from the perspective that I'm going to present, it's no coincidence that this is how things look nicest, because this is going to be become reinterpreted as the odd part of a certain superalgebra that I'll get to later. But anyway, so we'll group the fermions like this. Okay. Now let me just say. So far I've told you sort of. I haven't told you much about what the finite space is like. I've told you that I want to think of space-time. This fermion field lives over a space-time with that's a product of two parts, a continuous part parameterized by x and a discrete part parameterized by a. But I haven't told you much about the shape of the space or what it's like. And so in the approach that I'm going to describe to you, I'll give you that information now as follows. In this approach, I give that to you by telling you what is the next step is to tell you the algebra of coordinates on that space. And then to tell you how the algebra of coordinates acts on the fermion. Okay, so before I do that, let me pause to remind you what an algebra is. Okay, so an algebra is just a vector space, which you're all familiar with, a space where you can take linear combinations of vectors to get other vectors, but it's also equipped with a bilinear product. So you can take the product of two vectors to get another vector. So, you're familiar with a lot of examples of algebras, although you may not know it. So, the functions f of x on a manifold are an example, or on any space, are an example of an algebra, because you can take a linear combination of two functions to get another one, or you can also multiply them pointwise to get another one. Okay? That's an example of an algebra that's infinite dimensional, because the space of functions over a manifold is an infinite dimensional space. But it's commutative, because the product of two functions commutes. Another example are the n by n complex matrices. Okay, you can matrices form a vector space. You can take linear combinations of them to get another matrix. But you can also take the product of two matrices in the usual way to get another matrix. They form an algebra. That's a finite dimensional algebra. In this case, it would have dimension n squared, or 2n squared over the reals. And it's a non-commutative algebra because the product of two matrices doesn't commute. Okay, and then the final example that we'll need are the quaternions H, named after their inventor Hamilton. So just the quaternions, you may have met them. They're just like the complex numbers are a doubling of the reals, the quaternions are a doubling of the complex numbers. And so here, just as I the way I'll want to write them is just as I can write a complex number z, instead of writing it as a plus bi, I can write it as a 2x2 real matrix with real entries a and b. Analogously, I can write a quaternion as a 2x2 complex matrix with two complex entries, alpha and beta, like that. Okay, and so just like the product of those two of z and z prime gives back the usual product of complex numbers, the product of q and q prime written in this way give the product is equivalent to the product of ordinary quaternions. And just like I can embed the real numbers in the complex numbers as just the diagonal matrix with A's on the diagonal, I can embed the complex numbers in the quaternions, again, by just putting complex number on the diagonal and setting the off-diagonal elements to zero. So I'll use this notation Q lambda to denote the embedding of the complex numbers in the quaternions. Okay, so now I'm ready to give you the input on the non-commutative geometry side of things. Sorry, NCG, I don't think I said, is my abbreviation for non-commutative geometry, which I'm using because this extra finite space will be acted on, at least for now, by a algebra that is non-commutative. Okay, so so what is the algebra of coordinates on this product space? Well, on the continuous space, on the continuous 4D manifold, I'll just use the ordinary algebra of coordinates that you use in general relativity. In other words, the algebra of smooth functions on that 4D manifold. But on the finite space, I need to tell you what the algebra is, and I'm going to choose the algebra to be this one. 3x3 complex matrices, direct sum with the quaternions, direct sum with the complex number. Okay, and so an element of that will be a triple, m, q, lambda. M is a 3x3 matrix, q is a quaternion, and lambda is a complex number. And then, like I mentioned before, the other thing I need to tell you as input is the representation of that algebra. So I'm going to represent an element of that algebra is an 8x8 block diagonal matrix like this. So here we have a 2x2 block, a 2x2 block, 3x3 block, and a 1x1 block. Oh yeah, sure. You know, I tried it before and it didn't work. But, thank you. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so I've taken Q, lambda, and M, and put them in here. Q, lambda, here and here, and M. Okay, and they will be represented on the space of fermions that I mentioned before. Okay, I'll write the representation space like this. And so in particular, note that matrix can act on this space from both the left and the right. And so now we come to the first step in connecting this back to the ordinary physics of the standard model that you're familiar with. So I've drawn these sides in parallel because secretly they're giving the same input. So I've chosen this algebra up here to give the gauge group that I want to recover. So I've chosen M3 to get SU3, and I've chosen H to get SU2, and C to get U1. And then the basic idea in this approach is that the whole formalism will transform covariantly, will be invariant, I should say, under automorphisms of this algebra. So in particular, or not quite of this algebra, actually, I'll explain this a little bit more later, but it'll be invariant under automorphisms of a closely related algebra, which I'll describe in a bit, but for now, all you need to know is that to determine how the fermion fields transform under those automorphisms, where again, those automorphisms are playing the role of the gauge group over here, that group of automorphisms, to determine how they transform, well, the transformation is generated by taking the commutator here with the traceless anti-Hermitian parts of this algebra. Okay, this is a associative star algebra, and so you may know that the automorphisms of that are generated by the commutators with traceless, with anti-Hermitian elements of the algebra. Okay, so now here, this is an, at 4 points in the talk, I want to suggest, in case any of you are interested to understand this a bit better, there are four short, but not short enough to do them in the talk, calculations that I strongly suggest. Each of them is like a 5 or 10 minute exercise, and here's the first one. So exercise one is that if you just evaluate that commutator, commute those 2 8x8 matrices, you can read off how these guys transform. And the answer is they transform like this. They transform exactly like the fields in this table under this identification. Okay, so and where the three colors, red, green, and blue, refer to the three court colors that transform as triplets under SU3. Okay, so this has, by choosing the algebra and representing it this way, I have chosen that gauge group, and chosen that representation of its automorphisms on the fermion. Okay, so I've recovered the first two steps here, but given them in a very different looking way. Okay. So now what about step three? How do I get the scalar field in this approach? And that somehow is a...
Can I just ask you a question?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you quite explain the mapping from SU3 to the M3?
So you've shown how to transform it under the M3, but how do you then translate that into transformation under SU3?
So
you're somehow implicitly...
Right. So the whole thing is going to be set up. So I'll show you how. So at the end of the day, you know, the whole thing is. So the automorphism group of M3C, regarded as a star algebra, is SU3, and the statement is that on this side, everything will be arranged so that the formalism transforms covariantly with respect to automorphisms of the algebra. Not quite that algebra, but a related algebra that inherits the SU3 from this M3. So we'll in a moment, in a little bit later, we'll see actually how you write down the action on this side. And the point is that just like the basic principle over there is that that the action be invariant under that group of transformations over here. There's an analogous. Okay, so how do I, any other questions, by the way?
So can I ask?
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I guess where you're going with this is that you have, there's less input on the right-hand side than there's on the left-hand side, I guess. But on the left-hand side, some of these are just implied by, I guess, consistency or renormalizability of it, like Higgs, there isn't really.
You could put any number of Higgs fields you want, for example, and you could give them all sorts of different charges. The fact that the whole theory is gauge invariant, that plays an important role in renormalizability. But you could add more
right.
Higgs fields as much as you want with
okay,
different charges.
Sure. So that's, I guess, a question of minimal. Right.
You don't need any Higgs fields for it to be renormalizable. It wouldn't match the observations that we see of the world. All the fields would be massless, but it would be perfectly renormalizable.
To have the massless.
That's right. So the statement is not. I agree with you that it was already a good guess before we discovered the Higgs field,
mm-hmm.
that the Higgs field was there based on empirical grounds. The question is why? What puts it there besides? It's all these things. Everything on the left-hand side has been put in one way or another to match observations. The question is why do we see that EFP and not other ones? Are those all just unexplained inputs that we'll never know the answer to, or do some of those things have explanations?
Mm-hmm. All right.
Mm-hmm.
is a right-handed neutrino integral to this formalism, since we
on this side it is, yes. On that side it's not.
You may argue that it's simplest to view it as a dimension 5 operator without a right-handed neutrino.
It could be that. Yeah, we don't know yet whether there's really a right-handed neutrino living in. Yeah, that's what I was. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes. In other words, that's right. The observed neutrino oscillations do not prove that there is a right-handed neutrino in every generation of the standard model. That's the simplest renormalizable explanation for them. But as you say, it could also be explained just by the first dimension 5 operator in the standard model.
Without you're making a prediction for a new particle.
Right. Okay. So I want to say that in this approach, somehow the essential idea is that now we have the fermion field lives on this product spacetime with a continuous part and a discrete part. And so now the Dirac operator that acts on it, the differential operator that acts on it, has two pieces. It has the ordinary piece, the ordinary Dirac operator piece, corresponding to differentiating along the continuous directions in spacetime. But it has a new piece, which you have to include, which corresponds to, in some sense, differentiating along the discrete directions. And just like demanding covariance of the ordinary part of the Dirac operator forces you to add the gauge fields you want, in this case, demanding covariance of this two-piece Dirac operator forces you to add two things. It forces you to add gauge fields to make one part gauge invariant and Higgs fields to make the other part gauge invariant. So that's what I want to explain to you next. Okay, so in other words, I want to say that the Higgs field becomes reinterpreted in this formalism as another component of the gauge field. There's some generalized gauge field on this non-commutative space. Okay. So let me, as a warm-up, review the argument in ordinary gauge theory. So in ordinary gauge theory, we have some spinner fields, and they transform under a gauge transformation U, as shown there, where U is exponential of alpha I t, where alpha I, the gauge parameters, can depend on the spacetime coordinate x, and ti are the generators of the gauge group. And then what we want is a differential operator d, a Dirac operator that acts on those and transforms covariantly under a gauge transformation, as shown on the left, so that when we take the operator, when we take the object d psi and transform it, it just picks up a u in front. Okay, and so then the way you might meet this in your first field theory class, the calculation you usually do is you try the naive Dirac operator. With just the partial derivative, and you ask, does it transform like this? And you find that the answer is no. And that to fix the error, you have to add an extra bit here. And where in particular, A, mu, is a new field, the gauge field, that has to transform in a particular way. It has to transform in this particular fashion, infinitesimally, in order to fix the error that we previously had, make D covariant. Okay? So now I just want to rerun through the argument and see how things change when we have two bits. Okay, so we start the same way. We have that 8x8 matrix of psi fields that we want to transform covariantly. Now they transform under a gauge transformation, which secretly is the automorphism of the algebra I was talking about before. So the generators, Ti, we know what they are. They're the generators I told you before. They come from acting on psi with the commutator of a traceless anti-Hermitian element AI. Okay. But so far the story is the same. We want D, we want a differential operator D that acts on those guys, that acts on that fermion field and transforms covariantly. Okay, but now let's make an aside. So now the next step is supposed to be the step where we take the naive Dirac operator and test whether it transforms covariantly and add corrections as necessary. But you know, what naive Dirac operator should we take now that we're looking at this product based on? So we're looking again at the product of a continuous and a finite space, continuous and finite. So suppose that the continuous space has a naive Dirac operator D1, okay, this guy, and the finite space has a naive Dirac operator D2. Well, I haven't told you what that is yet, but that's it's the Dirac operator, whatever that is, on some finite space. So it's some finite n by n Hermitian matrix. I'll tell you more about it in a minute, but that's all you need to know for the moment. Then the naive Dirac operator on the product space is of this form. It's d tensor 1 plus 1 tensor d. And this is really the graded tensor, so that when you write it in terms of the normal tensor product, you pick up a factor of gamma 5 in front of here, but ignore that. It's just a technical point. Okay, so here I've written that down. Here's the naive Dirac operator I want to test the covariance of now. There's d tensor 1 plus 1 tensor d. So, you know, basically, once again, I find this is, so now this is my suggested exercise 2. Again, this is actually quite a quick thing to do. This is a less than 10-minute exercise. If you're interested, to go back and try it for yourself, I really recommend it. So, you know, this thing does not transform covariantly under the automorphisms generated by this. What we have to add in this case, we find we have to add a bit here and a bit here, okay, that look like this. So now here, what I've done is I've split DF into the part that commutes with TI, and the tau k are a basis for the part of DF that doesn't commute with TI, doesn't commute with the generator. Okay, so now, so just as in front of T sub k here, I have the gauge fields appearing in front of tau sub k, the basis for the non-commuting part of DF. I have these other fields appearing, which you notice have no spacetime index mu. They're what you would ordinarily describe as scalar fields. And so just as before, exactly the same argument, this guy has to transform infinitesimally like this to correct the error coming from that first term, while this guy has to transform in a slightly different way. Notice that there's no inhomogeneous bit here. And here, just like Fijk were the structure constants coming from the defined by the commutator with Pi with itself, the Gijk here are some different structure constants coming from the commutator of Pi with the tau. Okay, so in general, we see that these phis will transform in some different representation from the A's. Okay.
What's the definition of the taus?
So, I started by taking this DF, where I haven't told you what it is yet, but it's a finite matrix. It's going to be, so there's going to be some conditions that define what a Dirac operator is, which I will talk about momentarily, where those come from. But there's some notion of what a Dirac operator is even on a discrete space. So I have my discrete space considered separately from the continuous part. And there's the most general allowed Dirac operator on that space. It splits into a part that commutes with Ti, which is analogous to this part, which commutes with Ti, and a part which doesn't commute with Ti. And the tau k are a basis for the part that does not commute with Ti. OK, So again, I really recommend the exercise of just checking that this is what you needed to add, or and that with this, that this does transform covariantly onto that.
So sorry, the tiles don't come with any of the TIs?
Say it again.
Tiles don't come with any of the TIs. So this is this that G is not vanishing for
all I.
For all I.
The little G is.
So tau is a, you know, so it's like, so it. Well, that, so it's going to depend exactly what representation this is. That's what I'm going to get to in a moment. This is what representation I get. It could be that the scalar field, well, if the scalar fields did end up transforming, let's say all of these were zero, then I would just find that that's equivalent to saying I didn't need to add scalar fields at all, that the thing was already covariant without them. But exactly which elements here are zero or non-zero depend on what df is. So that's what I was about to say is, before you can do the exercise three, which is to work out what the scalar fields are and how they transform, I need to pause to tell you what df is. And then it's a matter of working out the commutators. And there's, yeah, depending on what basis you take, this is just some choice of basis on this base. Some of the components can be zero.
Is this with respect to the SU3, SU2U1 framework, or is this a more general slide, the TIs, the capital TIs?
This is a more general slide, but yeah, I'm about to, yeah.
This is completely general.
Yeah, this is completely general.
You could use it elsewhere in the multi verse.
Yeah, you could. Okay. Okay, so now I need to pull a trick out of a hat. So far I've been explaining things, and now I need to tell you something and then go back later and tell you where it came from. Or I that was the best way I could figure out how to tell this part. So I apologize for the slide that is about to come. again, it's for the purpose that if I do manage to interest any of you in the audience in really understanding what is going on here, this is like the key exercise you want to do, where you work out what are the scalar fields and how they transform and see that you do indeed get the standard model Higgs transforming in the right way. So I'm going to tell you what DF is. And then, as I say, I'll come back later and tell you about where it came from. But so DF is expressed like this. So it acts on the fermion field. It's the sum of three parts, a quark part, a lepton part, and a Majorana part, where delta Q, delta L, and delta M are just three different 8x8 matrices. And in each term, we sandwich psi between two copies of that matrix. OK, so here's what the matrices are. They say that they're 8x8. The only non-zero blocks are here and here. And then there's a unit matrix, 3x3 unit matrix here in the quark part. The lepton part looks the same. Two by two blocks here. But now we have zero in the 3x3 part and one in the remaining lower diagonal part. And then the Majorana part for the standard model has only two non-zero entries in the last row and column. Okay. And Y sub Q is forced by the formalism I'll describe to have, so the deltas are forced to be this way and the Ys are forced to be this way. So here YU, YD, YNU, and YE are just four complex numbers, which we will see in a moment will be nothing but the up, down, neutrino, and electron Yukawa couplings. And then when we here, so far I've been talking about three generations, so talking about just one generation, but when we go to three generations, all that happens is that each of these Ys becomes a 3x3 matrix, and mu also becomes a 3x3 matrix. And then phi 1 and phi 2, while we're just talking about the finite space, are again just two complex numbers. But the idea is that when you do the third exercise I just described, you compute the commutator of this df with Ti, you find that the only effect is that, so this is this part just completely commutes with all the TI, whereas these guys don't. They have non-vanishing commutator with the TI, but the effect of that non-vanishing commutator is just to, it leaves all the Ys invariant, just like you would expect for the Yukawa couplings. They don't transform under a gauge transformation. But the phi 1 and phi 2 transform into one another like the Higgs field, like the Higgs doublet. They transform as a doublet under SU2 with hypercharge plus 1/2 and SU3 charge, no SU3 charge, a singlet under SU. Okay. So as I say, that's an exercise that I can't do it on the screen for you in the middle of the talk, but I insist that it's not, if you're interested, you should dump, it's not, once you sit down with it, you'll see it's just a it's like a 10-minute calculation. It's really worth doing, I must say, in my opinion.
Sorry, can I stop you? So the form of the F that you wrote down, is that, so you're saying that's the unique form, or because you don't write?
I am going to say almost that, yeah.
Okay.
So let me get to that in one moment. So, but in short, yes, mm-hmm. roughly speaking.
Okay.
So now I want to do, you know, so now I've told you how to input. I've told you how to say what are the particles and their transformation properties on the left-hand side. You know, from an effective field theory standpoint, once I've told you all the particles, all the spin 1, spin 1/2, and spin 0 particles, and how they transform under the gauge fields, under the gauge group, then you're done. You know, you can just go off, if you're an effective field theorist, and write down the action. It's just the most, rule of the game is it's just the most general action you can write down. It's built from those fields and invariant under those symmetries. And so now I've told you the same part. I've told you what all the particles are, the spin 1/2 particles and the bosons, the spin 1 and spin 0 particles on this side, and how they transform. The exercise is to see that they're exactly the particles that appear in this table, and they transform in the same way. And so if you're an effective field theorist, again, on this side, you can take those fields and build the most general invariant action. Okay, but now I want to sort of let these two approaches fight and see which one does better, see which one has done a better job of specifying the input data. So over here, as I mentioned, we really chose this algebra to get exactly that gauge group. And any gauge group we chose over there, as long as you don't begin choosing exceptional Lie groups, any standard gauge group you would choose over there, you could have reproduced over here by an appropriate choice of algebra. So at step one, by my counting, the game is tied. Now step two, here we're giving a representation of the fermion of the gauge group on the fermions. Here we're giving a representation of the algebra on the fermions, but secretly we're also giving the representation of the gauge group on the fermions, because the gauge group on this side is nothing but the automorphism group of the algebra. Okay, but now this side pulls ahead. Not by super much, but a little bit. So I want to explain that first. So over here, you know, somehow the point is that the representation theory of groups, which are the fundamental objects on this side, is much, much, much less constrained than the representation theory of associative algebras, which is what we're representing over here. So on this side, consider SU2. SU2 has an infinite number of irreducible representations, singlet, a doublet, a triplet, a quadruplet, etc. So why is it that in nature we only see particles that appear in either the singlet or the fundamental representation? Similarly with SU3, there's an infinite power of different irreducible representations to choose from. Why is it that we happen to only see the singlet and the fundamental appearing in nature? Those are just unexplained inputs on this side. Another example is, you know, why is it that we only see particles that are charged under at most two non-abelian groups? You know, why don't we see in nature a particle, a fermion that's transforms under discharge under SU2, SU3, and SU4. Those are just unexplained inputs on this side. But on this side, those are all outputs. See, because the representation under the gauge group here is arising, emerges from the representation of the algebra, you can only get singlets and fundamentals on this side. And you can only get, you can only be charged under at most two different gauge groups as a consequence of the two different non-abelian charges as a consequence of the fact that this matrix can only act on the fermions in two ways, from the left and from the right. Okay, so it explains, there are maybe a few other things like that, but so it definitely explains more about this table on this side than on this side, although not to an extent that would probably convince anybody that there was anything special going on its own, but it's worth mentioning. But to me, this is the impressive bit that hints that there is something non-trivial going on, that this is not just that there's something better going on this side, which is that, so we pulled a little bit ahead in step two, but then in step three, well, on this side, step three was some completely independent input. On this side, there is no step three. Okay, so what Niyash said is basically correct, that once you specify the algebra of coordinates and its representation on the fermions on this side, then that turns out to constrain DF so much that the form of DF is essentially unique. Technically, there are four different choices. There are four different solutions to the constraint equations on DF, although the other three are are bad for other reasons. But in any case, whether there's one solution, which is exactly the right one, or four, it's dramatically more constrained on this side. And so the fact that the one solution that works, or four, depending on how lenient you are with what you call a solution, the fact that the solution you're forced to on this side, when you then turn the crank, not only produces the right gauge bosons, but then also produces the right Higgs field, I think is a very non-trivial bit of structure. Okay, so that somehow is, yeah?
Mm-hmm. When you say that these three extra representations of DF bet, do you mean from a phenomenological point of view or from a self-consistency point of view?
Well, I wish I could say the latter. I certainly mean from the former. But I also mean something in between, which is that... I'm a sucker for being lured into a tangent like that. You know, I wish I could, maybe I should leave it where it is. That eventually it will be the latter, but right now it's the former. Right now I can't claim the latter, although I wish I could.
There is no shame in testing things with data. So.
Well, that's true too, of course. And the other three possibilities are ruled out. That's true. Okay, and now I just want to mention one other thing, which is that another nice feature on this side is that the fermionic part of the standard model action now is greatly simplified. So here I've just repeated the covariant D we saw before, where DF is the DF I showed before. And now if you just sandwich it, you just take the inner product sandwiched between psi and psi, that is exactly that exactly reproduces all of the fermionic terms in the standard model. So all of the fermion kinetic terms and their gauge couplings and their Yukawa couplings and the bare mass terms. These are the bare mass terms. In the standard model, you only get those for the Meyer monolike self-coupling of the neutrinos, right-handed neutrinos. But anyway, it's really, you know, a significant neatening of that part of the action relative to on that side.
Didn't you say you had the choice of how many scalars you have?
Not on this side, I don't.
On this the 5K thing that you said there, you could choose that depending on the G's that you choose.
No, sorry. I didn't mean to say that, no. What I meant to say is on this side, once I get to step three, nothing about what I've added in steps one and two tells me what to add in step three.
Talk about the G's.
Over here, my statement is the following, that once I tell you this line, okay, and I tell you this line, that determines df, uh-huh, I turn it crank, and I compute what are the phi k's and how they transform. And so in particular, for the one of the four solutions, there's only four solutions for the constraints, okay, for one of those, the physically desirable one, I turn that crank, and at the same time that I get the right gauge bosons, I get the right scale. So yeah, in particular, you know, I can't get multiple Higgs bosons. Well, I don't. Not that I can't. I could have chosen different things here to do different things, but for the input that gets me the right first two steps here, I get the right third step.
Can you make a statement like if you try to get the top two parts of the table, you cannot have two Higgs bosons?
No. You almost can say that. It's much more constrained, but not quite. Not quite. You can't quite say it. Okay, so now I want to go back and very briefly somehow fill in the backstory, tell you about where this is coming from. So go way back. So Riemann and then Einstein told us that the right geometry for space-time was Riemannian geometry, where if you want to specify a geometry, the basic input you give, tell someone which geometry you're talking about, is you tell them what the manifold is and what the metric is, g nu, on that manifold. And then, for the past 30 years or so, or more, Hahn has been developing a notion of non-commutative geometry, which is supposed to sort of somehow generalize this to the case where the coordinate algebra is no longer just the commutative algebra of functions, but can be non-commutative. So he has led to this formalism where he gives different input data. It's supposed to be secretly, so he gives different input data. He gives a so-called spectral triple consisting of an algebra A naught, those algebra coordinates, Hilbert space of spinners, and a Dirac operator in some generalized sense, and that satisfies some axioms. And then there's, because the standard model is even dimensional real manifold geometry, there are these two other objects that also appear in the formalism. Anyway. So somehow, without giving any details, those are the objects that he works with. And over the years, he and collaborators, I should say, and other researchers, this is quite a large field, and they've developed axioms that these, and various axioms and rules and assumptions that these objects are supposed to obey, so that all of the different nice calculations you do in geometry and topology and K-theory all have nice non-commutative generalizations. But so now if you look at the list of axioms that has accrued over the years, it's really quite a long and not just the ones that are formally called axioms, but then there's a whole bunch of other assumptions and definitions that go into specifying a geometry in the modern way of, in the current way of doing things in that formalism. Okay, so but we were interested in this because it seemed to have something to do with the standard model. We were trying to investigate that. And in particular, we were wondering about the case where A was non-associative. Just curious about whether you could somehow make this whole formalism work in the case where the algebra is non-associative. I should say non-associative is like still a kind of a bit of a bad word in physics talks, but really, when you're dealing with algebras, a lot of the most beautiful algebras are non-associative, including Lie algebras. So non-associative algebras are great. And so somehow the starting point here is that you represent this algebra on H, on a Hilbert space. And what would that even mean for a non-associative algebra, we wondered. And so great mathematician Samuel Eilenberg back in the 40s gave a nice answer to that question, very simple answer. He takes A naught and H and he defines another algebra, very simple super algebra, called B naught. I won't give you the definition, but the key point is that by just demanding that B naught have exactly the same properties as A naught, that A naught is an associative algebra, by demanding that B naught is an associative algebra, you recover the usual definition of a representation of A on H. But then the advantage of this approach is that it nicely generalizes to the case where A is non-associative. So you get a very natural generalization if A is some other kind of non-associative algebra. So a Jordan algebra here, and you take this thing to be a Jordan algebra, that gives a very good definition of what a representation of a Jordan algebra is. That has been very fruitful. Okay, so if you have to summarize in one line what our paper from April was about, it was the observation that even though this was originally invented for the non-associative case, it applies very nicely in the associative case. And the only thing we did, briefly, is that instead of representing A naught, the algebra of functions, coordinates on the space, we used Eilenberg's same trick, but we applied it to A, the so-called universal differential graded algebra over A naught. So just like if you have functions on a manifold, there's a way to construct the algebra of differential forms over those functions. There's an analogous thing you can do with non-commutative algebras. There's this thing called the universal differential graded algebra over A naught. But you do the same thing that Eilenberg did. You define the same algebra B, but now since this was just an associative algebra, so that, you know, back when he originally was considering it, this was just an algebra. This thing now has more structure. It's a so-called differential graded algebra, and it's a star algebra, and it's associative. Okay, so the natural thing to do here is to demand that this thing have the same properties again. That it be an associative differential graded star algebra, which let me not get into what all those things mean, but except that a differential graded algebra, you're all familiar with that. The algebra of forms, the exterior algebra of forms, where you multiply M and N forms and get an M plus N form, and by taking their wedge product, and you can take the differential of an M form to get an M plus 1 form. Okay, differential graded algebras are, that's the canonical example. They're very beautiful objects. Sorry, I have to blaze through a little bit because I'm running out of time. So I want to say that, so this had a bunch of, so what we realized was that representing the differential in this guy, extending it from A to B, meant it had to have a bit that acted on H, which was essentially the Dirac operator, and that then demanding that this algebra B be an associative differential graded star algebra, unified and reproduced nearly all of this, what I had said was this very long sort of arbitrary seeming list of axioms and assumptions that have accrued over the years up here. Okay, so demanding that this thing be a differential graded associative star algebra is almost the same thing as what Kahn is usually doing in non-commutative geometry. But it's not quite the same thing. Okay, so the first thing is that the fact that it unifies that long list of axioms is already a mathematical hint that maybe this is a good thing to do, like a sort of step in the right direction towards something or other. But the key point is that actually demanding that this is an associative differential graded star algebra is more restrictive. It implies a few more restrictions that were not on this list, and in particular, more restrictions on D than were on this list. And those extra restrictions are strong enough that they force DF, that if you apply this formalism to the, so you know, Kahn's claim has been that the standard model, his traditional way of phrasing it was that the standard model was described by a spectral triple. If you take that spectral triple and use it to define this algebra B, then the extra constraints you get here exactly force DF to have the right form that I mentioned before, whereas it had to be put in as an arbitrary choice up here. It now comes out simply as a consequence of this simplified formalism. Okay? And so, in particular, already this formalism up here was a more restrictive way than effective field theory of speculating about what's beyond the standard model, more explanatory about the standard model, more restrictive for speculating about beyond the standard model physics. And now this new formalism is even more so. It explains even more about the standard model, in particular the thing I stressed before about step three, the choice of scalar fields becoming an output rather than an input, relies on this reformulation. And it's a more restrictive formalism for thinking about beyond the standard model physics. Okay. Three minutes? Okay. Okay. Let me see. Let's choose the best stuff here. So, another thing that has never been clear in the traditional formalism, Kahn had this very good intuition that he was onto something about the connection between noncommutative geometry and the standard model, but it was never clear what was the relationship between the symmetries of the theory and the underlying geometry. But now there is a clear answer. Okay, the physical symmetries of the theory that come out are nothing but the automorphisms of this algebra B. B is the basic object. That's very natural. The inner algebra automorphisms come in two parts. There are so-called inner and outer ones. The inner ones are the ones we discussed. I didn't mention this before. We were just looking at the inner ones. Those give exactly the structure of the standard model. But then there are also additional outer automorphisms. Those correspond to the diffeomorphisms, the automorphisms of the ordinary function part of the algebra. And then there's one more outer automorphism, which is an extra gauge symmetry, U1B minus L symmetry. And consequently, you end up predicting two new particles that, in addition to the ordinary particles in the standard model. So a new U1B minus L gauge field, and then a new scalar field that's not charged under any of the normal standard model charges, but is charged under this B minus L, and gauges the new B minus L gauge field. And then somehow now the last step is I'm going to pull the wool completely out. I'm going to pull the rug out from under everything I've said. Just 2 weeks ago, I realized something, which I'm really excited about, but I dithered about whether to present the whole talk from this standpoint. But it turns out that here we had assumed that this was that A naught was an associative but non-commutative algebra, and so A was also the differential graded algebra over it, and so was B. Turns out if you just keep that same idea, but really instead of an associative algebra, you should be dealing with a Jordan algebra, then that really works much better. And so just very briefly, it actually turns out apparently the structure of the standard model, it's still the same story I told you, continuous 4D space, finite discrete part. But there are two different ways to look at the finite discrete part, and one of them is better than the other, although they're very closely related. So, you know, a Jordan algebra is the kind of algebra you get, just like a Lie algebra is the algebra you get if you take anti-Hermitian matrices and take the product to be the commutator. The Jordan algebra is the flip side of that. It's where you take Hermitian matrices and take the product to be the anti-commutator. So it was originally invented for describing the algebra of observables in quantum mechanics, which are Hermitian matrices. So there are these very beautiful algebras, but instead of being associative and non-commutative, so being non-commutative geometry, they're exactly the opposite. They're commutative because the product is the anti-commutator, and non-associative. Not wildly non-associative. They're non-associative in a very beautiful, structured way. But anyway, so somehow that's a very important point. That's sort of the future. I'll skip over exactly. you know, there are really a bunch of interesting things for the future, which I will not talk about to not violate my promise to Xioma too badly, but I'll just say, you know, in summary, I tried to tell you that the universe looks like this. I personally have come to think that that is, that there's, I think it's likely that that is the case. I wish I could say definitively that that was the case, but even for me, the evidence is not that strong. But I really encourage anyone who's interested to do those four exercises I mentioned in the talk. And I think you will come to the view, like me, that there is really something non-trivial going on. And then there's really a lot of interesting stuff left to do. And in particular, this Jordan algebra business is going to be totally awesome. I don't have time to explain it, but it's like so super cool, I can't even tell you. Okay, that's all. Thank you for listening.
I recently watched a lecture by Idea, and he tried to link the classification of associative algebras to the standard model, because you have the, well, complex numbers, you have the quaternions, you have the octonions, and then you run out. And then if you go further, then you have to lose more of your structure in your algebra.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not an expert in this, but this looks like a lot into that direction, so I was wondering, what would happen if you also include the octonions? Because then you basically run out and you have only a finite set of algebras which satisfy the associative condition. And would it be a candidate to go beyond the standard model?
I'm with you. I totally agree with you. So that's right. So there's these, the famous statement is there's really four number systems, four norm division algebras.
Indeed.
The reals, the complex numbers, the quaternions, and the octonions. And the octonions are very beautiful. The non-associative is sort of the biggest guy in the bunch. And all of the exceptional structures, many, many different, whenever you do a classification of anything in mathematics, anything good, you get kind of a families of normal objects, and then you get a few exceptional cases. And those exceptional cases are really all coming from, all related to the octonions. So when you classify Lie algebras, you get these three classical infinite families, but then you get these five exceptional cases that all really come from this thing called the magic square over the octonions. And so just like I was explaining before, that Jordan algebras are really the flip side of Lie algebras. Instead of taking anti-Hermitian matrices with a commutator as the product, you take Hermitian with anti-commutator as the product. Okay, so those also are classified, and it's very similar to the Lie algebra classification. There's three analogous classical families of Jordan algebras, infinite families. And then in that case, there's just one exceptional case, the so-called exceptional Jordan algebra here. I should say exceptional, which is the algebra of 3x3 Hermitian matrices with entries that are octonions. And so the structure of the standard model is beginning to smell an awful lot like this thing. Although I also should say I've been trying to make it for years smell more like it, and it's not exactly, it doesn't, hasn't gotten anything to work yet. But so, but you know, the what smells like it, you know, there's, okay, so first of all, I was saying that I recently realized that the coordinate algebra should be not an associative algebra, but one of these Jordan algebras. And then, but it still has this property that for each generation, the algebra is some 8x8 matrix, the octonions are an eight-dimensional algebra, and then there are three. Currently, an unexplained fact about the standard model is that there's three families that are identical copies, and the exceptional Jordan algebra is this 3x3 matrix over the octonions. What can I say? The short story is that it has some tantalizing relationships, but then it has other things that seem like they're going to be a real problem. So I don't know. I don't know how to make it work, but I do think it's an exciting idea.
Thank you.
So you may have said it, and I may have misapologized for this. How do you explain the fact that because you embed all the families in the same representation, so how do you explain the fact that different gauge groups have different couplings and there are different UCAVAs? So how do you, so what is the scale where this happens? Do you expect the gauge couplings to unify at a higher scale and this happens, or?
That's a very good question. That's another, that's a very interesting question. So, I told you, I told you about how you specify what the particles are over here and then how to write down the, then you could take the effective field theorist standpoint and just take all those particles and write down the most general thing you could as if they just, as if there were no structure to those particles besides their gauge charges. And you would get back the standard model. And then in particular, there's this simple way to write the fermion action. Now, you notice I didn't write down the scalar part of the action with a corresponding simple form. Now, there's a famous old idea due to Kahn and Lott, kind of beautiful idea, which was that, okay, we have this generalized gauge field here, which now has sort of two pieces. If we regard this as the new A mu, a beautiful thing would be if we could take this generalized A mu, calculate the generalized F mu nu, and take F squared and have that be the bosonic part of the action. Now, formally, that looks great. It has all the right terms in it. It has the normal gauge F squared gauge kinetic term, but then it also has the kinetic term for the scalar field and the Higgs and the gauge coupling of the Higgs field and potential terms for the Higgs field. But like you say, if you just do that, when they did that, they indeed found that all of the couplings were not independent of one another. They got some predicted extra relations between them. And then those predictions turn out to be wrong. That's one thing that I, I'm working on it now. You know, my dream was to have it done before this colloquium, but I didn't make it. But, this Jordan algebra business, sorry. So that's top item here. Indeed, there's reason to hope that there's something more ambitious than you can do than just use plain effective field theory when writing down the bosonic part of the action that would predict relations. On the other hand, if you do that and then it predicts wrong relations, then that's not so good. The story changes with the Jordan algebra business because a problem with associative but non-commutative algebras is that even though people have written down formally this algebra, the universal differential graded algebra over the base algebra, it doesn't behave, it's never behaved as nicely as the ordinary algebra of differential forms that we're used to on spacetime. Okay, it's missing a lot of, it's not nice in a lot of ways. And in particular, there's these things called junk forms that make no sense. And so in order to even define their F squared, they had to do some very dodgy thing where they threw away the junk and they did some stuff that probably, I bet it wasn't right when they were calculating their F squared. So on the other hand, Jordan algebra is a commutative algebra, just like the ordinary algebra over which the algebra of differential forms is defined. And so you can really define differential forms over it in exactly the same way. It's just that you have to keep track. There's some restriction on that. You have to keep track of, for instance. So there is a very natural notion of what, in that case, a very natural notion of what the F is, that is the field strength is corresponding to A. And it has to be rechecked. Or if you try F squared there, if maybe that predicts correct relations, that would be needless to say, very exciting. But also probably it's unlikely that it's going to work. But I'm trying. You know, we'll see if it works or not.
Kahn claimed that his relations would only hold at, you know, some high energy scale. You have to renormalize and all sorts of things. He claimed they were quantum corrections.
Right. Well, that, yeah, you know, maybe I'll just say a little bit more about that. This is part of what I was saying when I, there's a part of his story that he usually talks about, which is, which they believe the bosonic part of the action. They will write it now as, they take the full D and they take trace of F of D over some scale lambda. And then they do this so-called heat kernel expansion, and that predicts some relations. Yeah, you know, I don't believe those relations. So there's two, basically, to make a long story short, first of all, they're not preserved by the renormalization group, which seems like a bad sign. And then even if you do run them down to low, even if you don't worry about that and run them down to low scales, there's one of them that does kind of match observations, but then there's several others that really don't match observations. And so it doesn't look right. So I think there's some great formula for the bosonic part of the action, but it remains to be written down. I hope it's this thing, but I don't know.
So, how can we test this?
That's a very good question. This thing, if F squared predicts new relations between couplings, then those will, you know, very likely. It's not fair because if that postdiction rules out my theory, you'll take it very seriously. But if it agrees with the standard model, you'll discount it as a postdiction. But that will very likely be a test that will kill this. Will kill that formula.
This is something that is not required by something else in the FEFT picture. Then I guess it is an achievement, right? It benefits the postdiction.
It would be very exciting if it did just turn out to match some relation, which is
okay.
Why it would be so exciting that it seems very likely that it won't work. But beyond that, I would say that if you take the spectral triple if you take the geometry that appears to match the structure of the standard model, again there is this. There are these two extra predicted particles. Now it's not clear whether at what scale those. I don't know.
One of them is presumably a Higgs kind of field, which would give the right-handed neutrino.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So, in other words, so to give the CSUN mechanism, it kind of looks like its VEV is up near the gut scale.
Mm.
So it's sounds hard
to
measure,
but it would make cosmic strings.
Yes, that's true. Uh-huh. Beyond that, as I say, this is not as strong a statement as I would like to make, but it's a much more restrictive framework for speculating about theories beyond the standard model. So normally, when you do particle physics beyond the standard model, you're just working with effective field theory. You can write down a ginormous number of different possibilities. Here, you can still write down a lot of possibilities, but many, in some sense, dramatically fewer. There are a lot more predictions about beyond the standard model physics than effective field theory.
So the rules of the game is that you just start with a different algebra, or a bigger algebra, which has this other,
Yeah. But so for example, you can only get fermions living in singlets or fundamentals. They can only live in at most two different fundamentals.
Already have an infinite number of predictions. You can predict that the LHC is not going to discover.
That's true.
And every day that passes, you can claim that.
Every day they don't discover anything. That's true, yes. Right. So, but maybe the more, maybe another thing to say is that, here, SO10 is another example of a really, what to my money, a big clue about the standard model. I mean, those who aren't familiar with this, there's 16 fermions in one generation of the standard model, and it was observed back in the 70s that if you imagine that all of those 16 are nothing but the 16 components of the of the Weyl spinner representation of SO10, and then you break SO10 down to SU3 times SU2 times U1, that 16 splits into exactly the six irreducible multiplets that you see in nature with exactly the right SU3 times SU2 times U1 charges. So I remember when I, in grad school, I heard an introductory talk about this by Ed Witten where he had a wording that I liked, which was that life is too short to work on models that assume that's a coincidence, which I think is a good way to say it. Like, it's not the same as saying that the proposed SO10 grand unified theories are correct, but that it seems very hard to believe that that is just, seems, the way he's, I can't do it better, than what he said, but I would say that somehow in terms of speculating about beyond the standard model physics, you know, so I think there are these two clues about the standard model. There's this one that I was describing during the talk, and there's this SO10 one, but if you think of them in terms of which one is more in your face, you know, the one that I talked about here is really something about the structure of physics at the electroweak scale, and the other one is up at the gut scale. So in somehow, if you know, it's another thing about speculating beyond the standard model of physics. I don't know exactly what to make of this fact, if you buy it, that that space-time has a finite discrete part. You know, is that just some approximation to something? Is that, I don't know, you know what, I'm not sure where exactly that goes. But it seems kind of in terms of an ordering of energy scales that one should make sense of that thing first before taking too seriously extrapolations, 12 orders of magnitude beyond that or whatever, to make sense of this hint. So, you know, my impression would be that I kind of, you know, agree with the statement as he said it. I believe that statement more than I believe current speculations about actual grand unified theories based on just imagining that this just field theory in four dimensions. I think that's good.
Do you have a regulator that's consistent with your gauge transformation?
That's an important point. I don't know how to do quantum mechanics. That's an important thing I should have mentioned. So I think everything I'm describing here is really about a more succinct explanatory way to describe the classical Lagrangian of the standard model. And I think that the fact that, you know, I think that I and certainly Kahn has always had the perspective that the fact that the geometry is slightly non-commutative is a hint that it has to do with quantum mechanics. I've been worrying about that for a long time, and now that I think I'm really quite confident that the right description, the even more correct description is to take the algebra on the finite space to be this commutative Jordan algebra. I increasingly think it's something about classical mechanics, this is saying, not really about quantum mechanics. So I don't really know how to do quantum mechanics. No, not there yet. So I don't know how to do the path integral. I don't know how to write down the path integral really. Apart from just taking the normal effective field theory you would write down and writing down the ordinary. Pretending that the world is just field theory again and writing down the one you would have written down in those fields, but I don't know whether that's the right thing to do or not.
I guess maybe given the time you can keep your questions.
3:30. Yeah, that's a good point. So if anyone does try those exercises and gets stuck, just talk to me. I said they were 10 minutes, but if you get totally stuck, that's probably my fault, not yours, and so I can get you unstuck. Or if you want to talk about more, please come talk to me. There's really a lot to say.
Okay, that's good.